Thank you, Gary. Thank you, Professor Trude. And ana iwi ana hoa tanakoto 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 katoa. That greeting in te reo Māori to all peoples and all voices does seem very appropriate for an occasion that marks the 70th anniversary of the United Nations. And I've got to say, I'm also very pleased to be able to make this presentation barely 3 months after I finished my six-year term, almost parallel with Gary's, as our ambassador, New Zealand's ambassador to the United Nations. That experience is still, I can assure you, very relevant. And again, as Gary will confirm, what a time it was to be at the United Nations. Think, just for example, of the Arab Spring. Not a very good name, I've got to tell you. Springs mean to last 3 months. This thing could be three generations in the doing and undoing. Or of an ambassador unwilling to continue serving his regime, resigning in public in front of the Security Council. And I could go on with many other examples, but then, along with those highlights, my day job at the UN required me to do just two things. First, to lead a team of experts who every day, along with 192 others, represent their countries in negotiations critical to their country's interests. And secondly, to lead our representation on the UN Security Council, and before that, obviously, to secure election to the Council. New Zealand is far from much that tears and tramples at the rest of the world. So why then does it engage so actively at the UN? Why did it go head to head with two G20, NATO, Northern Hemisphere heavyweights, Spain and Turkey, to win a seat at its high table? By any measure, New Zealand should have finished a distant third in that three-horse race, and yet we secured 75% of the vote. Today, however, is not about campaigns. Once you've done it, it's history. The whys and the hows are now only relevant to what happens next, and particularly how we engage at the Council table, and indeed how we engage across the whole of the UN's wider agenda. Let me, however, acknowledge the very significant help and support of Australia for our campaign, from whom we borrowed much of the experience of its successful campaign. In addition to taking every opportunity to show obvious and visible support for our candidature, Australia helped us by its own performance as a two-year member of the Council in 2013-2014. That was counterintuitive. Conventional UN wisdom suggested the General Assembly wouldn't be attracted to what some saw as a four-year trans-Tasman seat. And I've got to say that initially I got that reaction from some quarters. But first of all, your diplomats very willingly rebutted any suggestion of a four-year policy continuum, and Australia's own Council performance removed any doubts or concerns about how we might behave on the Council. And so, by voting day in mid-October of last year, that concern was long behind us. So I want to say, Gary, thank you to you and your team. You didn't just do Australia proud, you did us proud as well. But we couldn't have achieved our success without viable foreign policy settings. And in our case, the key elements of those settings are broadly supported by all of our major political parties, which means that our policy is consistent and isn't subject to sudden swings. New Zealand is a country that's long been committed to strong bilateral, multilateral and regional relationships and to working with others. And we do that for the very practical reason that our size means that we can do very little by ourselves. So multilateral engagement is really very important for small countries like New Zealand. We are able to achieve things that we wouldn't have been able to achieve bilaterally. A very good example. Under the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, we have the world's fourth largest exclusive economic zone. Our extended continental shelf is five times larger than that. And those are outcomes we could never achieve without other than within the framework of a multilateral agreement such as UNCLOS. So multilateral engagement is very important to small countries. Indeed, over 100 small states, those with populations of less than 10 million, are UN members. In the General Assembly, the vote of the very smallest, Nauru, with 10,500 people, carries the same weight as that of China, with 1.3 or 1.4 billion people. And that means that the vote is still, that vote is very important. There are many examples of how small states have played important roles at the UN and elsewhere. That, however, is not really the subject for today's address. Because despite all that small states do at the UN, the reality is that it is the UN Security Council and only the Council that can make binding decisions. It is unquestionably the high table of international relations. Indeed, it's often said of its agenda that if you're not at the table, you are probably on the menu. And it's an organ of the UN that's often and quite rightly criticised as unrepresentative of today's geopolitical reality, unrepresentative of the UN as a whole, and is unaccountable with opaque working methods. So let's look at some of those shortcomings. First, one can't escape the fact that the Council is dominated by its five permanent members, the P5. And that, I've got to say, is undesirable, it's unhealthy, it might even threaten the Council's longer-term credibility, as Gareth Evans suggested this morning, but it is the reality. Second, the Council's structure dates back to 1945, when the great powers of that time, US, UK, France, USSR and China, secured permanent membership and the right to veto Council decisions. It's a structure that reflects the realities, the geopolitical realities of 1945, not those of 2015. Third, despite those widely acknowledged shortcomings, that structure is unlikely to change anytime soon. For nearly 20 years, the General Assembly has conducted what it calls intergovernmental negotiations on Security Council reform. That title doesn't describe it. There are no negotiations. Ambassadors read out statements carefully prepared and vetted in capitals to ensure consistency with everything that's been said before and before that and before that. Nothing new is added. No one has authority to negotiate, even to negotiate ad referendum, or on a nothing is agreed until everything is agreed basis. In other words, there are no negotiations. Any attempt to break through that impasse, for example, with a chairman's draft or even a zero draft, is blocked by those who don't want any reform that might advantage one of their regional rivals. Fourth, the Council's working methods are opaque and they lack transfer accountability. And that, too, threatens the Council's credibility. Here, at least, there is occasional progress and improvement. Australia was responsible for much of that during its term, but much more still needs to be done. In our 8 months on the Council, for example, New Zealand has worked to ensure that countries on the agenda have a fair opportunity to be heard. An amazing proposition, really, when you think about it. Fifth, the P5 veto has proved every bit as undesirable as its original opponents predicted. New Zealand and Australia opposed the veto in San Francisco in 1945. It was the only UN Charter provision forced to a vote. Everything else was agreed by consensus. But needless to say, the P5 had the votes. Now, France, one of the P5, has proposed a code of conduct whereby the P5 would collectively renounce their veto powers in mass atrocity situations, for which read currently Syria, Ukraine and elsewhere. New Zealand supports that proposal and during its presidency held a closed council consultation to discuss this and other ideas that might improve the council's working methods and thus its credibility. The original council had 6, later 10, non-permanent members. But despite now having nearly twice as many non-permanent members, for most purposes, the P5 still dominates. The United Nations needs, but presently lacks, a strong, nimble, effective Security Council to deal with crucial issues of international peace and security, and it needs a council that reflects the geopolitical realities of today not those of 1945. I could go on the same themes, but the reality is that the Council could lack credibility if it doesn't address those issues. Which leads me then to ask, well, what is the Council currently dealing with? I could go through the list of items that were on its agenda in July, the last full month, when New Zealand was actually presiding over the Council. But I think it's better that, in fact, we leave that until the Q&A session that's to follow, which will be an opportunity to address specific issues, if that is your wish. Suffice to say that we had two headline events in the course of that Council meeting. The first was, in the course of that Council month, the first was to hold an open debate on the peace and security challenges faced by small island developing states, a first in every sense and critical to the interests of those states. And our other signature event was the closed consultation on the veto and other working methods to which I referred a few moments ago. But there are many issues that made it onto the agenda in July, and many more that are of concern to the Council but simply were not addressed on that particular occasion. You should note, however, the absence of any Pacific trouble spots. The region hasn't been without its past problems. Civil war in Bougainville, coup d'etat in Fiji, near collapse in the Solomons, and of course Timor-Leste, now a post-conflict society which is helping others through the same experience. New Zealand and Australia share with others, and particularly with regional organisations, a special responsibility for stability and security in the Pacific. We tend to play a low-key leadership role, but we have both recently concluded lengthy commitments to the Solomons and Timor-Leste. Ladies and gentlemen, it is very easy and very fashionable to criticise the UN. It's only ever as good as its last headline, which might read, Council fails to agree on Syria, or Ukraine, or elsewhere. That headline could, of course, just as easily read, Council agrees action on Mali, or Iran, or a dozen other crises. But agreement and action don't fit the critics' agenda. In truth, the Council has dealt with many threats to international peace and security. It has, by consensus, agreed 16 current peacekeeping mandates involving 106,000 uniformed personnel and another 17,000 civilians from 125 UN member states. That's pretty impressive, really. The UN is, in fact, much more than failures to agree. For every perceived failure, that same UN is out there keeping the peace and ending conflicts, delivering humanitarian assistance, clearing mines, distributing food, treating disease, rebuilding governance in failed states. The list goes on, and fundamentally, human life improves. Let me perhaps leave you with some thoughts about the role played by the UN over the past 70 years, which might inform our thinking about the future. The United Nations resulted, as we've been told, from the lessons of history, from fatal misjudgments, economic protectionism, for example, to fatal compromises, Chamberlain at Munich, all of which gave the world its worst ever global depression, the most destructive war in human history, massive human rights violations, and of course the failure of the League of Nations. But those same lessons also gave us the United Nations, a United Nations projected to end the scourge of war. The task of achieving real peace still confronts us today, made all the more pressing, all the more urgent by Middle East issues, the ongoing Arab Spring, and by events in Africa, Asia, and elsewhere. One often encounters skepticism about the readiness, the willingness, and the ability of the United Nations to respond and deal with such issues. But those skeptics should be reminded that the United Nations was created to meet challenges that were once so overwhelming that people could only see solutions in economic protectionism and aggressive war, and that dealing with those issues by other, more peaceful means was never going to be easy. I'm ever mindful of the fact that mine was the first generation of the 20th century that wasn't called to a global war, and that despite many destructive regional conflicts, there hasn't been another world war. The UN alone hasn't delivered that global peace. European unity has been crucial, as has Asian economic development. In the future, the African Union might well play a role, and the Americas now have just one issue, Haiti, on the Council agenda. But the UN has played a critical, central role in freeing the world globally from the scourge of war. And that certainly is why New Zealand is prepared to engage and contribute at its high table.